Good evening. Coming to you from Heathensburg, Pennsylvania, this is Doubting Dogma. I am your host, Molly Ann Mormon, and joining me again, our Mormon historian, well, historian of Mormonness, or something like that, that too. Bryce Blankenagel of the Naked Mormonism podcast. Bryce, thanks for coming back.
Well, thanks for having me again, Molly. The first conversation was too much fun. I couldn't just let you get off the hook with one.
You make it sound dirty. Anyways.
It was a quickie, everybody. It was quick.
Oh, 50 minutes is a quickie. I need. Anyways, moving on.
All right.
All right. So, I really wanted to have you on because, well, we went into this a little bit last time, but July 24th is Pioneer Day. And it's funny because when you look it up in like Wikipedia and stuff, it doesn't say it's a Mormon holiday, but it is.
Oh, yeah.
It says it's like celebrated across the Western states, but it's not. It's celebrated in Utah.
Yeah. And with its own, like, they forego the 4th of July parade just so they can have a 24th of July parade instead. Like, it's just a Utah thing.
Yeah, and, I mean, they've got, everything. I've only seen part of it once because we were only there when it was going on 1 year. And actually, I believe that was the sesquicentennial year when we were there.
Very nice. Lucky you.
Yeah. We watched some of it from my aunt's living room on TV, because it's all on TV there.
Yep.
So it's celebrating when Brigham Young brought them into the Salt Lake Valley in 1847.
Nice, so that faithful year.
Been, yeah, it has now been almost, well, in a month, less than a month, 170 years.
That's crazy to me to think that's when the first people plopped down and said, yeah, Utah, this desertscape, yeah, with that huge lake full of nothing but salt. Yeah, this is a good place to settle down, guys. Let's pop a squat here.
Let's do this.
I cannot comprehend it.
I don't know. But, I mean, it makes me feel old because that means that a score of years ago, I was doing the reenactments with the hand carts in Wyoming.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if you were, because I'm a wee bit older than you. I don't know if you were old enough that you saw any of that, or I don't even know if the Utah Mormons went and did any of that, or if it was just us psychotic nut jobs down there in Colorado.
No, it was a big to-do. Like, I never watched any of it, but I do remember hearing about the reenactment of it. You know, I went on Pioneer Trek, which is different than the actual reenactment, because that reenactment, I mean, there was something like, what, 2,000 people or something that walked?
Did it? I don't know. I'm not talking... Well, there was the group that did the full trek. They reenacted the full thing, and they are...
Crazy bastards.
I don't know. Yeah, I was going to say mentally deranged. But no, we went up to... it was up there around Casper, Wyoming-ish. Is that the Sweetwater River, I want to say?
That's... Martin's Cove area, right?
Yeah. And they had the little visitor center, and we'd get our little hand carts, and we had our pioneer garb that... I mean, We had sewn our skirts and our bonnets. This was part of our young women's for that year. Every time we had our little meetings, we were planning out, you know, the packing list, and we were getting with our quote unquote family because we'd had our ma and pa and then our other siblings and that was our handcart family. And so we were planning all this stuff, and then we had to carpool out there and...
Yep.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, I remember it quite well. And I assume you remember doing the women's pull as well, where they just, like, had all the guys drop off for huge hill.
Because they were going away to join the
battalion.
Yes, the Mormon battalion. I was like, what's that word?
And they went, and it's such a weird thing too. Like, oh, the Mormon battalion. Oh, they must have been in some epic battles. No, they made a couple of roads. That's it. That's all they did.
They walked down to like the Mexican border and back, or something like that. I mean, that was it. Yeah, they did a bunch of walking around and left their wives to die on the plains by themselves, or something. I mean.
Yay.
Am I being too cynical?
That's exactly what it was. Yes, exactly.
It was bad because, like, well, not bad, but truth be told, the guys that were in my quote-unquote family, the most of them were, I mean, they were the younger guys, like, they were the deacons, the a couple of 12-year-old guys that they thought this all was stupid, and so they weren't really helping with the handcart anyways. Oh, so it's like, well, what were we missing? Let's be honest.
I remember that. But, yeah, I do actually. I thought Trek was actually pretty fun when I went on it. You know, I didn't really, like, care much for the spiritual parts where we'd sit around the fire at night and, like, bear our testimonies to each other, and where they had, like, the scripture reading thing where you'd go out into the woods and read the scriptures for a couple hours. I think I went out there and napped. You know, I didn't care much for that, but the fact that I was, like, dressed up in old-timey garb and, you know, had a serious stank about me and was playing out in the woods, that was actually pretty fun to me.
We had to sew pantaloons?
No, we didn't have, like, we didn't sew.
No, we did.
The DI.
No, like, we had the girls, we had to wear, like, pantaloons.
Oh, my
God. We made pantaloons to go under our skirts. So we had the little bloomers that came down just under our knees and had little frills there, and I was, oh my gosh.
Oh, that's amazing.
Now when did you go on the trek? Was that like that first year? Because you were, I want to say you were what, like six or something like that?
No, so they just do Trek like every year or every 2 years or whatever. It just rotates around what stakes do it. So I think I went when I was maybe 14. I would have been back in like 03, 04, something like that.
Okay. Yeah, I went like, I guess the sesquicentennial was the first time they did this, so far as I know, that they started doing those treks. And so it was the first summer and everything. So it was this big deal.
Yeah, and I think that was a really special one, because that's when they had the people that were reenacting it and doing the actual walking. But I was under the impression that Trek had been going for a number of decades prior to it. I could be wrong, but I just, like, I know, you know, I had heard all of the stories of my fellow priesthood members and fellow young women's people who had gone on Trek and said that it was so much fun, and I remember anticipating it and then learning what we were doing and saying, well, that sounds like it sucks. But when I was out there, it was actually pretty fun. But it's just kind of like a camp out. It's a week long camp out, basically. Yeah. And you're just walking the whole time and pushing these old ass wooden carts. That's about it.
Yeah. Yeah, see, because I don't remember ever hearing about it before that year. But then after that, it was, so that's why I thought that was the first year that they had that going on, because it was the sesquicentennial, and so it's all special because they're like, yay, 150 years.
Yeah, right.
Since we decided to make this suicidal trek across the planet. Yeah.
And go build
suicidal for like a whole bunch of us.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you know, most of the treks, most of the actual handcart companies have moved out. They did so successfully, and they got to Utah, and they realized that it was a fucking desert wasteland, and nobody wanted to live there, and that's why Brigham Young chose it.
Because and they're like, what the flipping hell are we doing here?
Like, yeah, what did I step into? I clearly didn't read the fine print in this one. But, there were some of these handcart companies that were a little bit more ill-fated than others. And luckily for us, we don't live in frontier America where this is just a reality of living, where we could just, that week was fun. Now let's go to the grocery store. You know, I kind of like living in our time a little bit more than frontier America.
Yeah, but then, I mean, when we'd go on the trek, oh, it was a horrible week. It was so windy. I'm not saying like...
Because that's Wyoming.
Experience. Well, yeah. Wyoming has nothing there to stop the wind. So, I mean, it's just... NASA would love it for their wind tunnel because they wouldn't have to set anything up.
Yeah, they just have to get everything to Wyoming, which is logistically challenging because they just got an interstate like last year. I mean,
and it's under construction.
Yeah, always, always.
Wyoming state trees. But anyways, those are the only trees around.
Yeah.
But when we were on trek and it was so windy, like we had this tent for our family and we were using modern tents. You know, we didn't go
and gas old
timey and get, yeah. And I mean, it was blowing so hard, like the top of our tent, which it was a dome tent and it was a pretty good size one too. Cause we had, I want to say like 5 or 6 people in this tent. So it was a decent sized tent and you could actually stand up in it. So it was tall too, but the wind was blowing so hard. It seemed like it was just diagonal or kind of trapezoidy. Cause I mean, the top of it was like leaning to the side and it was horrible.
I mean, just Wyoming. Okay. So I used to drive a truck up in Wyoming a couple times a week and the people
there. I don't know how you stayed awake.
The springtime there is. If you think it's windy at any time in Wyoming, if you go to Cheyenne or Casper or any of these places in the springtime, and that's when it's god awful winds. And you talk to any of the locals, they're like, "Oh, it's not windy here. It's just that Nebraska sucks and Utah blows. That's what it is." And but it is such a god-awful shithole. The only things literally on my route driving through Wyoming and, you know, northeastern Colorado, my mile markers were windmill farms and nuclear missile silos. That's all that's out there because there isn't any civilization. There's sagebrush and fucking lizards, but there's not any people living out there.
Well, it's funny because my family goes up to Yellowstone every summer. Right. So driving from Denver, one day trip, you know, you go up and at Rawlins, you hit 287, you go north. And about halfway between Rawlins and Casper, there's this little tiny town. And town is being very generous because you know, on the sign, it says Lamont, population 3.
No shit. If there's any sign that captures everything that is Wyoming, that is it.
And so it's like that became our big joking point, you know, because we saw this when we were kids and we're like, what? So then every year we're like looking for Lamont because if you, you know, blink, you'll literally gonna miss it. Because there's, I swear, there's only like a barn on the one side and a house on the other or something. I mean, there's no post office that you can see. There's no gas station. There's literally nothing. But
you hear of those towns that are like one stoplight towns. This place isn't even big enough for a stop sign, people. There's
it's
nothing.
It's not even big enough for a yield. Are you kidding me?
You're
lucky if you have a cattle guard.
And that's on the main highway.
Yeah.
So then you've been to Martin's Cove then. You've actually seen where they camped out, where the Martin Hen camped
and out. And actually, when you climb up on those rocks, there's actually spots where they had carved their names and dates and stuff into the rock face.
That was amazing to see.
I saw that. You know, and then one of the things they always like to talk about is one of the stories about the William Martin Handcart Company, where I guess they were trying to cross the Sweetwater River, and it was 3 young men carried everybody across, and they ended up like dying from exposure.
That's the story. That's the story they teach.
Yes, because
But.
Because they had so much faith and so much giving and such service to their, and they are guaranteed a place in the celestial kingdom, and we need to strive to be like them and be, because they were so good. So, yeah, you know, this is the kind of stuff you hear when you're dressed up like a old-timey pioneer dragging a cart around. Okay.
Well, and the thing about that story is it's like, it's as you said, it's like a faith-building experience. You know, these people are so amazing. Look at their faith. They're so such powerful Mormons. They knew how important it was to make it across the plains, and they don't really tell you much of the actual history and how many poor logistical decisions were made. It just that caused more than 100 people to die from these handcart companies. Like,
they left too late, and so they weren't going to make it, and all this kind of in time before the winter storms hit. And mm-hmm. I forget why they went into, or what they said about why they still made that choice to go and everything when they knew they weren't going to make it in time. But
yeah, I don't know.
It's been 20 years.
Yeah, exactly. I can't think of any rational decision why they would do it. I just know some of the things that led up to why they departed so late. But the decision-making process, they should have wintered in Nebraska. They should have stayed near Florence. They should have stayed in Iowa. They should have not gone across the plains, because they doomed people to die as soon as they said, yeah. No, it's late in the season. We're still going for it. It's hot out right now. We're going to be all right. A number of bad decisions led to the Martin Willie Handcart companies, yeah, having a massive number of their people, their constituents, die from frostbite or you know, die from hypothermia,
exposure,
or have
yeah.
an exposure, or just have to have chunks of limbs or entire limbs removed because they were just dead from frostbite. I mean, yeah. It was a myriad of terrible decisions and really extenuating circumstances that caused this to happen.
And really, any time your choice is better to stay in Nebraska, you know you're in dire straits.
Yeah, you know you've made a couple of bad decisions leading up to that.
You need to reevaluate your life choices at that point. But okay, so let's start off at the beginning, since so many of our listeners are going to be like, well, what the hell is a handcart? To begin with.
Yeah, okay. Really early down. Let's really start at the very beginning of this.
All
so,
right.
So, man came from Adam and Eve, and we were... No, okay, so really, a handcart... these people, as part of this handcart company... The saints were making their immigration from Nauvoo to Utah, beginning in 1840, late 45, early 46. They finally landed in 1847. That's why we have the days of 47. July 24th is this big day in Mormonism in Utah, because that's when Brigham Young got there with the first handcart company. And then in the subsequent... about two decades up until they had a train that was connected, the Pacific Railroad train that was connected in Promontory Point, the only way to get to Utah, to the new Mormon Zion, was just walking. Literally just walking and pushing these wooden carts that were just shittily, haphazardly built, thrown together so that they could logistically make a settlement work in a place where nobody wanted to settle, because that's what Salt Lake City was.
Well, and then I remember hearing some of the carts, there were too many people trying to cross the plains, so they're trying to rush these orders to make these carts, and they're making them out of green wood. So then they start shrinking from losing all the moisture and stuff, and then the metal rims on the wheels are falling off because they didn't do it right.
Yeah.
Which just compounds their problems horribly.
Well, so the entire process of like making the hand carts was actually done quite smartly thanks to Brigham Young. You know, as I call him Bloody Brigham, he was a manager. You know, Joseph was the idea guy. Brigham Young was the guy who knew how to run a business. And even even in the 1840s, he still owned a very successful tavern in New York City when he was running it from Utah, essentially, and keeping a steady stream of income to his own personal piggy bank from this tavern. So he was a smart businessman, and what he did, you know, this was before Henry Ford was even, or I think even before Henry Ford's dad was born. Henry Ford, you know, he's credited with creating a mass production line for the Ford Motor Company, but Brigham Young did that for hand carts, and he said, you know, he devoted these blacksmiths in these certain shops in Nauvoo to saying, you build wheels. You over here, you build boxes. You over here, you build bearings for the wheels. Like, you build the undercarriage. You build, like, he had these various things that were built up to specific, you know, to spec. And then they would piece them all together and then send them out. But that also did cause issues, like using green wood and the green wood shrinking, you know, the moisture drying out of it. And yeah, it created a lot of problems, but it did streamline the process and make the entire thing logistically possible. So it was handled smartly, but it happens that, you know, with the Martin Willie Handcar Company, by the mid-1850s, when they came along, they were running out of wood that they could use, so they were just cutting down any forest that they possibly could get access to in Nebraska and Iowa, and slapping these carts together and sending them on their way. That was all that they could do.
Trees in Nebraska?
Right? Not anymore, because the Mormons cut them all down. But there were over 100 Mormon settlements in just Nebraska, because they were spread out far and wide in preparation, you know, starting in winter quarters, which is just north of Omaha. There were, you know, over 100 settlements where they were building these hand carts and trying to, you know, plant enough staple crops in the ground that they could harvest enough to send these handcart companies with across the plains so that they wouldn't starve. And, you know, it was terribly conceived, and it just so happens that by chance they were able to make it work somehow. I cannot figure it out.
Oh, the whole thing just sounds like a horror story to me, because I'm like...
Yeah, absolutely. But so that kind of sets the precursor of how the Martin and Willie handcart companies came to be. And those were two separate handcart companies, but they're often looped together because they left 2 weeks apart. So they left in August of 1856. Now, when you're going to travel more than 1,000 miles on foot across the plains with, you know, over 1,000 people, you need a few months to make that happen. But
August is not the time to do that.
No. That's a really bad time. Like, in every possible conception of the word bad, that was the perfect way to do it. So the thing is,
it snows in Colorado in August sometimes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
In fact, in Yellowstone on August 25th, they celebrate Christmas. Because I guess in 1900-something, it actually snowed them in on August 25th. Like,
that's Wyoming.
Blizzard hit. Yeah, and that's exactly what they're going through. They're about to go walking across Wyoming thinking this is a good idea. No,
it was really a terrible idea. But it was also, they didn't really have much of a different option, because the handcar companies totaled over 1,100 people. That's 1,000, you know, that's a lot of people that you have to find homes for if they're going to winter in Nebraska. Then didn't really have the resources for them, so they just kind of sent them on their way. But they left because they came primarily from, let's see, it says... the immigrants, the 1856 immigrants, were British and Scandinavian converts en route to the new Mormon homeland in Utah. And this is taken from ohiohistory.org. And that they were, you know, they had left in, I think it was May. They had left, departed Liverpool in May. So by the time they got to Nebraska, it was August. And they said, well, we need to buy these hand carts and we need to get our asses out on the trail so we can get to Utah by the time the year is over. And that was kind of their first mistake. They got to Nebraska way too late in the year to begin this trek, but they still decided to proceed with it. And that was, well, they kind of... Well, they sealed their fate when they said, we're going to do this anyway.
Well, and saying they come from Liverpool makes me wonder a little bit about if they even knew how bad the winters would get here, because I've been to England in the winter, and yeah, it gets cold, but they don't get terribly a lot of snow. I mean, they get some, but because it's an island and there's so much coastal air and whatever, like, they don't get the mountains like they get when it comes across the Rocky Mountains and it hits those plains.
Oh, yeah.
And so I wonder if part of that may have been from their ignorance and them thinking, well, there might be a little snow, but it won't be anything that we can't handle.
Yeah, that does, you know, I never considered it that way, but I think you're right, because the kind of snow they get in Wyoming is, it's otherworldly. Like, it shouldn't exist on Earth, but it does. And, you know, people who are coming from Europe who may have experienced Mediterranean, more temperate winters, being plopped into the middle of Wyoming during a massive blizzard, that's going to be some serious shock for many, many different reasons. And one of the main problems with this whole trip, so they departed on August, so the Willie Handcart Company left August 17th and the Martin Company left August 27th. I mean, you're already starting out on this when the days are hot, but the nights are cold. You're at the end of summer when it's starting to get really bitter out there. So these people coming out and not knowing what the Plain States weather is like in the winter, that might have given them a false sense of security. Oh, we can handle it. We'll be all right. So it was ill-fated to begin with, and the fact that they left at that time, they got to...
August is one of the hottest months.
Yeah.
And so they're like, well, we're sweating our balls off here. We'll be fine.
If only they knew. But as they were continuing across the plains and getting closer to Wyoming, they realized, guys, we're not making enough time. We gotta speed this up. But these carts are really heavy. You know what would lighten up these carts? If we threw all of our clothes out and burned them. So they did.
Oh.
They reduced the amount that each person could have of personal properties from 17 pounds to 10 pounds. And the only thing that people had that they could throw out, they weren't going to throw out food stores. They weren't going to throw out the various materials that they needed in order to settle in Utah once they got there. The only expendable weight that they had were clothes and blankets. So they threw out all of their winter clothing that would have helped them survive the blizzard that was coming in October before they even got to Wyoming. And that right there, that simple action of throwing their clothes out and burning them, that probably cost the majority of the lives of the people that died out of the Martin Willie Handcart companies.
Oh my gosh. I don't remember if I heard about that part, but oh, that is horrifying.
Yeah, but they did it out of necessity, because had they, well, and also you think about it, had they kept that extra weight, you know, seven extra pounds that are taken off of 1,100 people, that's a lot of weight. That is, you know, a few tons of weight that you're removing. That does make the trip faster and easier. It makes it easier for the oxen to continue pulling the handcarts when otherwise they would have been too exhausted to continue forth. So if they would have kept that extra weight, who knows? They might have taken even longer to get to Utah, and more of them might have died. So it's a huge catch-22.
Well, not oxen, because these are handcarts. They didn't have oxen.
They did have oxen, though. The majority of them were pushed by handcarts, but they did have covered wagons that were pulled by oxen.
Okay, because I was like, the handcarts were not with the oxen. Okay.
No. It's that's only because they don't want to have oxen out on like trek nowadays, because they're just a huge pain in the ass. But like they actually had oxen, and by the end of it, they were, you know, the oxen that would die, they were just grinding them up and feeding the oxen parts that they weren't eating themselves to the other oxen, and it was causing sickness not only in themselves but in the few animals that they did make the trek with. So it was ill-fated from the beginning with that too. And by the end of this, so they had everything calculated out. They had, okay, we're going to set out with this many pounds of flour, this many pounds of meat, this many pounds of X and X and X, and that will make it so we can get to Utah if our trip is, you know, this long, we have this many people consuming this amount. But they had to ration that by the time they got to Wyoming, because October 19th hit and they crossed the little Sweetwater River, which was just a creek in Martin's Cove area. And this October 19th blizzard hit, and it's thought that within 5 days, 56 people died just from that one blizzard. And that's, you know, that's all part of the more than 200 people that died out of the handcart companies, but they were snowed in Wyoming, in Martin's Cove, where you went on handcart trek. The Martin handcart company was snowed in there for 9 days. They couldn't move, they couldn't do anything because they were surrounded by feet of snow.
Yeah, and if anyone wants to draw this visual, here is Martin's Cove, as I recall it from 20 years ago. There's some rocks, and I mean, well, they're pretty tall cliffs, but it's still incredibly open, and the river is right there. So
yeah,
you're going to have that wind coming across the snow, coming across the river, like probably just hitting that rock face and maybe giving you a little bit of shelter or not.
Yeah.
But not much as I recall, because I believe the cliff face is facing the wrong way. It's going east-west, I think, so it's not going to block that wind that always comes from the west.
Yeah. Well, that is what's special about the little Martin's Cove. You know, they have the visitor center and that big ranch, and they have a little blacksmith shop and everything there. But where the actual cove where they stayed, they're surrounded by cliff faces, basically. And then there's this massive mound in front that kind of shields them a little bit from the west direction. And it was enough where there were some trees there. They were able to kind of hunker down for those 9 days, but they were still burning through rations. Like, they weren't able to go across the plains and continue further on in their journey. They were still using up their already scarce resources. So this kind of plays into the culmination of bad decisions that were made at this time. And additionally, you know, these people, they had the resources set out that they, you know, calculated out that they needed to cross, but they didn't plan on being snowed in for 9 days and having to trudge through. And, you know, even after being snowed in, there was still snow on the ground, which slows progress significantly. Yes. So by the time they were done, you know, most people, when they started, each person got a pound of flour for cakes and for whatever as their ration at the beginning. By the end of it, adults were only getting 8 ounces of flour and children only got 4 ounces of flour. So they were heavily rationed because they didn't have enough resources to, you know, keep up full rations. And that made it so these people were starving. They didn't have the energy in their body necessary to help them move across, which caused even more hypothermia and sickness and death from exposure, because they simply didn't have the calories to sustain life. So it's a huge culmination of really terrible events all coming together that caused more than 200 people to die from this. But luckily, so the from my understanding, the blizzard that hit them came across from the west. So when the blizzard hit in Utah, Brigham Young knew that blizzard was going, it was headed straight for the Martin Willie Handcart companies. So he sent out relief parties almost instantly when he realized that they were going to be stuck in Wyoming. And that was good, because without those relief parties, the number of people that died, yeah, who knows? They might have just been lost and all of them froze. I mean, who knows what would have happened if not for the relief parties. So they sent out a ton of resources. They sent out by the end of it, let me see if I can find the actual number here. there was a relief party of 77 teams and wagons making their way eastward to provide a rescue party for them. And when they finally arrived, it was in early November when they finally met up with the Martin Hancock Company. Because the Willie Hancock Company was still 2 weeks ahead, they made it into Utah with very little, you know, minimal relief. But the Martin Hancock Company, they were stuck 2 weeks behind. So Brigham knew that, hey, we got to get people out there to help them. So when the relief party arrived, they were able to load up everybody from the Martin Hancock Company into wagons, so they no longer had to walk, which was good because most of them couldn't walk at that point.
They didn't have the energy. They were just too sick and frostbitten.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So finally, come November 30th, that's when the Martin Hancock Company got in. And just from the Martin Hancock Company, that was 145 members of them died. Now, when we're talking about the Martin and Willie Hancock Companies, it was pretty evenly split of the 1,100 people. So they were, you know, about 550 to 600 people in each of the companies. You lose 145 of those people. I mean, that is a twice decimation. That is an absolute obliteration of your membership. Just all they just froze. They died. They just didn't have any way to continue walking, and you couldn't go back and rescue somebody, or else you were gonna die too. So it's not like this was taken lightly. I mean, a hefty percentage of these people died. You know, more than 20% of the total 1,100 died. That's crazy.
Yeah.
So it's not a happy story. I mean, the Martin Willie Hancock Company, it was just the product of bad decision making, bad timing, and, you know, just a number of exterior pressures that caused them to just die. They just died by the droves, and there was nothing anybody could do to stop it from happening.
And it's just shocking that this is – well, and this is the story that they always like to go to when they talk about the faithfulness of the saints going across the plains. And it's just insane.
Here's a quote from a guy named Ephraim Hanks, who was one of the rescue parties. He said, quote, "The starved forms and haggard countenances of the poor sufferers as they moved about slowly, shivering with cold to prepare their scanty evening meal, was enough to touch the stoutest heart. They hailed me with joy inexpressible. There was only one day's quarter ration left in the camp." So, I mean, without those rescue parties, it's likely that all, you know, 600 people of the Martin Hancock Company would have perished, you know. And I really try and play with hypotheticals in my mind. How would that be treated today if every one of them had died? Like, as it stands right now, it's like, oh, look at the faithfulness of them, you know. They persevered. They got snowed in, and it was a historic blizzard, and they still persevered and still made the trek to Salt Lake City because they knew salvation awaited them. When you actually talk about the reality of this and just how horrifically desperate they were and how melancholy it must have been in those camps to see your friends and family just go to bed at night and not wake up because they froze to death in the middle of the night. I mean, there's no way that we can see what it must have been like. And then to know that when they got to Utah, it's a fucking shit splat desert wasteland, and that's what was waiting for them. And the majority of the people, like the majority of the population in Utah, they were not well off either. They didn't have much to spare. You know, they brought the companies, the people from these companies, into their homes and cared for them through the winter. But, I mean, once they got to Utah, they were responsible for everything for themselves. The church didn't really help them out. So it's not so much a faith-building story when you know the actual history of it. It's much more of a look how bad things can go when a few small decisions are made that lead to this huge culmination of shitty events. And unfortunately, it's not sold that way. It's sold as a faith-building experience because they were just so faithful.
Yeah. And like I said, they always bring up those young men that carried everybody else across the river. And then they died, and but they gave up their life for their brothers. So, so they're going to be in the celestial kingdom. And I mean, jeez.
Yeah, and I think this, if we can use this as kind of a microcosm of Mormon history in general, like, this is something about Mormonism that people don't like to talk about, and that is the bad shit. And unfortunately, there's a ton of that in Mormon history that they don't really, they don't get into. They talk about, you know, a sermon that Joseph Smith gave and how faith-building it was, but they don't talk about, you know, him marrying a 14-year-old. Because those are like, those are the scary things we don't want to talk about.
No, they never talk about that, but... Oh, jeez. And there, I mean, there are times that, like, I want to just ask my dad and be like, so, from a hat, huh? And just see what he says, but, you know, I don't want to... Yeah, the pot any more than has already been stirred.
Because that's hard to bring up, right? When they've, when, you know, a TBM has heard a story and used it as a faith-building experience, and you know the reality of it is a faith-shattering experience, it's really hard to approach somebody with that, you know, fundamental shift, that paradigm shift of how we should perceive these stories. Especially when their, you know, their eternity is incumbent upon their belief in knowing that whatever is claimed about this said story is true. That makes it even harder.
Yeah, and the fact that the whole religion hinges on him and the Book of Mormon. And without either one of those, the whole thing falls apart. And then you start looking at, okay, well, oh, you'll like this part. This is another thing I noticed when I started reading the Book of Mormon again. So we start out with Nephi, of course, 600 BC. Mm-hmm. And then he passes it to his little brother. And I figure Nephi had to have been at least a teenager when they went into the wilderness. Yeah. You know, because he said he was large in stature, and they always portray him as this big buff dude and whatever, and looks like 25 or something. But I figure youngest, he had to be at least 14, 15, maybe 18. He then passes the plates on to his little brother, who was born while they were in the wilderness. Well, 8 years after they were in the wilderness, sometime within those 8 years, his little brother was born, who is then the one who gets the plates. Same generation, technically, right? And then he passes it to his son. So Nephi passes it to Jacob, who passes it to his son, Jerem, who then passes it to Omni. And by the time it reaches Omni, it's been like, what was it? Like 165 years or something like that. Yeah, and I'm like, if you look at it, it's three generations. And I did the math on this, and I was like, that's like saying that my grandfather was with Brigham Young going to Salt Lake.
Oh, wow. That makes sense. I never thought about that. I thought you were going to talk about like population statistics where, you know, as soon as you get into Messiah, there are... Yeah. But
how soon does he get in Second Nephi? He's like, and they were many upon the land. And... But the fact that it's been like three generations and it's been 165 years and I'm like, no, that's not how this works.
Yeah, those are some old ass generations. Those are like biblical generations right there.
Yeah, but if you can even look it up and it says, well, even then, you know, statistically, people still lived, you know, high side. Like, the average age was younger. The average life expectancy was younger because there were so many baby deaths and stuff. The infant mortality rate was horrible. But still, people would still live to, like, 70 or so. But no. Even if one right after the other, right after the other. But that means that they're popping a kid out and handing their infants on the plates for it to be three generations. it don't work that way.
Yeah, right? That's not biology. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I brought that up to my younger sister, and she actually served a mission to the Missouri Independence Mission.
Very cool place. Now I can speak from first-person experience. I like Independence.
See, I haven't been there, and I haven't been to Nauvoo or any of those, because when my parents went, I was already in the college and the Army and stuff, so I never went to those. But
highly recommended. They're really cool.
I brought these years up to my sister, and I'm like, so what about this? And she's like, I don't know. I'm like, okay then. So
that's probably the best answer you can get instead of some bullshit apologetic. Yeah, if you can get Norma to say.
She was just like, huh. Yeah, I don't have an answer for that. And I'm like, well, it just, that's not how that works.
Right, you don't have to have an answer. You just have to look into it for yourself. Like, that's, man, hopefully agnosticism on some of these questions is about the best we can do with so many Mormons. Yeah. So,
yeah. But I was just like, that, I mean, well, that and the fact that, you know, everybody likes to bring up his steel sword, the steel bow.
Yeah, and, right. Yeah. You know, I recently had a kind of a similar interaction with a family member at this family reunion in Moab. And I was talking to them very skimming on the surface of a couple of historical topics. And she said to me very honestly, she's like, I don't really like LDS.org very much just because everything is so fluffy there. So she asked some of the resources that I use, and I said, well, you know, to not be too challenging or anything to beliefs, or if you're just wanting like a straight middle of the road type of analysis of certain topics, I recommend Mormon Think. And she said, oh, I love Mormon Think. I had to stop for just a second and say, that is amazing, because the only Mormons that know about the website Mormon Think are Mormons who have actually Googled something about the church. And as soon as you read a couple of articles from Mormon Think, it doesn't take long to become disillusioned with LDS.org and Fair Mormon and stuff. So, like, as soon as you can get a Mormon researching, a TBM getting into websites like Mormon Think or into, you know, any real historical book that's not a church-approved website, I think that's a really crucial first step. And the first way to make that step, to start taking that step, is to get them to admit, oh, I don't know. And then, well, Google it. Look it up for yourself. I don't know the answers. You don't know the answers. Let's figure it out together. Like, that's really powerful of a tool to have.
Yeah, because one thing, when I started reading the Book of Mormon again this last time, I was like, I want to look at this timeline and just see. You know, because when Joseph's sitting there with his face and his stanky hat, just making crap up. I mean, I guess he wasn't thinking realistic years and lifespans or something. Or he thought that Methuselah was joining him or something. I don't know.
So a guy who saw parchment appear in his hat, you're saying he didn't exactly have a solid grounding in reality? Blasphemy.
Blasphemy. Except he can't charge me with it now. I had my name removed.
Oh, there you go. Bingo. I actually kind of wanted to talk to you a little bit, if you don't mind a quick digression away from any history, but I kind of wanted to talk to you about your walk through Mormonism, just to get a little bit of perspective on that. You said you've been out for like 6 months now?
Six months. It was December 13th that I dropped my letter saying I was baptized when I was a child, so therefore I was not at the age of consent, and so remove me from the rolls. Don't contact me except with the statement saying that I am no longer a member. So I dropped that in the mailbox, sent it off, started freaking out because I'm like, what did I just do? You know, but at the same time, you know, because like I mentioned, I mean, I almost sent that letter when mom had told me that she had had a child before she met my dad and adopted him and then didn't tell me simply because I wasn't married. And the advice she got was that I would repeat that because then I would see it as acceptable since I wasn't married, was the reason she was given for not telling me.
So then let me ask you kind of what led up to this December 13th. Was this more of an intellectual pursuit that led you to say this is bullshit, or was it more just like the emotion of like the church has fucked over my relationship with my parents and my family and I'm just sick and done with this? Like, what kind of led you up to that fateful December 13th day?
Well, had I sent the letter off when mom told me about my half brother, that was strictly emotional at that point. Though with my going to church and back years, I mean, I quit going because I didn't feel comfortable there. I was like, I don't feel like I belong. You know, I'm 31, I'm 32, I'm too old for the singles ward, so I'm the lone single bastard here in the family ward. How freaking weird is this? I mean, and there's like this complete stigma about, what have you done? You know,
why aren't you married yet?
Yeah,
you're in your 30s. Why don't you have 30 kids?
That's exactly it. It's like, well, are you reading your scriptures and praying? Are you praying for a husband? Are you doing this? Are you going to the activities? And so it's like, the reason I'm not married is my fault. It's not the fact that, you know, this guy I dated was a creep and had issues of its own and basically called me a whore because I wouldn't sleep with him. So, you know, no, it's not his fault. It's my fault because, you know, this environment of, well, because you're not married at, you know, by the time you got kicked out of the singles ward because you're too old, therefore you did something wrong.
Yeah, there must be something wrong with you as a person, right?
Or that you're not righteous enough, you know, you're doing the wrong things, you know, all this stuff. I have issues now, but anyways.
Well, it's when you're given that perspective and that is your entire upbringing and your understanding of reality, it's kind of a hard thing to break away from. I mean, especially being so green out of the church too. I mean, only 6 months, that's not a lot of time to heal from the mindfuck that you experienced for the rest of your life leading up to this last 6 months.
Yeah, and then because my husband is pagan, right? He left Christianity years ago. When he went to England, he went to Stonehenge and he was like, there's an energy about this place. There's something about this. So now he's like, I'm the oldest religion on the planet, you know, kind of thing. So he's like, yeah.
All right. Whatever makes me happy. I mean,
but as far as like his, I don't know, he doesn't like practice anything.
Right. And he's just not out there marching against gay rallies and stuff. Like,
no, I mean, he just, you know, so when we had our wedding, it was a pagan hand fasting. So what we did was, like, we had a Wiccan priestess perform the ceremony. Cool. And, like, you know, so we have the circle and the priestess casts the circle. And so we go to each of the cardinal points and then we stand there and join hands. And with each of our vows, she drapes a cord across our hands. And then, you know, it's all symbolic and like these cords are bound, so too are you by your vows and this kind of thing. So we had that, and Riss was actually the one who videoed our wedding. So that's how I met Riss.
That's awesome.
And then, you know, I was like, oh, well, we need a couple extra videos because mom wants one and stuff. And she was like, well, just, you know, give a couple bucks to my Patreon page, then we'll be square. And so then I was like, well, okay, if I'm going to be like, you know, paying money to this podcast, I should listen to it. So I started listening to her podcast. And her podcast at the time wasn't really atheist stuff. Like, I mean, she said that she was.
Yeah, but that was when it was captured, the actual inciting incident part of it, right?
Yeah. they still had like the this little segment they called Troper's Lament, where they talked about little movie tropes and this kind of stuff.
Okay.
And then I finished their back catalog and I'm like, well, now what? You know, and I was like, well, she talked about the scathing atheist, so I don't know. So I tried an episode of that and it was still too scathy.
Okay. Like,
and yep. Then she was like, well, Cognitive Dissonance is good. And so I started listening to Cognitive Dissonance. And I started listening to them in, like, I want to say August. Mm-hmm. And I finished their entire back catalog in, I want to say, 4 months.
Wow, no kidding.
I mean, I've got an hour drive to work, an hour drive back. So, I mean, I was just killing it on just listening to all their episodes. And from there, I moved to Scathing Atheist. And then it wasn't too scathy. And I was like, yeah, it is a load of bullcrap.
Right, yeah.
And so, honestly, you know, it was Tom Cecil, Noah Heath and Eli, and Lucinda that turned me into a little heathen. So, and they don't even know it. But, I mean, I got to go to the GAM Live in January back in Chicago.
And I somehow didn't meet you there?
I guess not, because I was there.
I was there, too. There were a lot of names and faces and a lot of people. Maybe we saw each other there, but I don't recall meeting
you. I don't know. But, like, the highlight of my thing, I was like, I got to meet Tom and Cecil. And I got to give Tom a hug. And I was like, woo! I'm like, I'm Totes fangirling! You know, but... But... I mean, yeah, that's...
So that's been... I mean, now you have your own podcast out of this. I mean, you've kind of... It sounds like you've gone through the intellectual pursuits of...
Yeah, because...
Like, transitioning, so...
Back in October, I started writing a blog about my journey away from the church.
Mm-hmm.
And just different little points here and there about, well... You know, like I brought up the age thing in the Book of Mormon when I came across it. And I was bringing up points on this book I was reading, an autobiography called Housewife to Heretic. And it's written by Sonia Johnson. And she was excommunicated for fighting for the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment in the 70s, trying to get women equal rights under the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And she was excommunicated for that.
Imagine that.
Yeah, because how dare you little women even think that you can, you know...
Tell a man what to do? How dare you?
And it's just... It's interesting because, like, growing up, you know... I mean, yeah, my parents wanted us to... go to college and this kind of stuff, but it was never, oh, you can be whatever you want. You can do whatever you want. You can do this or this or this, you know? And yeah, no, it was always, well, you want to get married in the temple. So make sure you're worthy for your husband.
Right. When I mean, we talked about this. I can't remember if it was in the A segment or if it was before we hit the record or whenever, but it's
I don't know.
It's really sad.
So many segments going on.
Right. But it's really sad when somebody's entire worth as a human being is their genitals.
Yeah.
You know, their ability to reproduce. That is the entire plight of the women's trajectory in the church is you make sure that you're a worthy wife to marry a good return missionary, temple-going priest holder.
Yeah. And
so that you can bear him some babies. Like, that's it.
And we're groomed that growing up, you know, you want a return missionary. You want a return missionary. And so when you go and you sit down with the patriarch, because you talk with him for a minute before he gives you your patriarchal blessing, you know, he's asking you about things you want. I want to know if I'm going to marry a return missionary. So, of course, when he gives you your blessing, and you shall meet a return missionary, and you shall fall in love and have little babies, you know, and...
And it's not any one thing. It's a million little things all along the way that groom you for this.
Yeah, and it's just constant. I mean, from the day they take you up there as a baby to give you your name and a blessing, I mean, that's where it starts.
Yeah.
And it doesn't stop.
Yeah, it's true.
Oh.
It's, you know, I have to occasionally take a step back and ask myself why I do what I do. Because it's a question that is asked by a couple of family members and people who are interested in what it is that is, you know, the lifestyle of exposing Mormonism. And, you know, I don't always have a succinct answer for myself. And it oftentimes varies from day to day of why I'm doing this. But just the entire, like, hearing, especially, like, your extremely fresh perspective of this, it shows just how, I don't know how to say this, it shows how much damage can be done over a lifetime of indoctrination. And anything to mitigate that damage, anything that any of us can do to help reduce some of the cult mindset of people who are in a cult, I think is, over and all, by and large, a good thing. But unfortunately, it's not, that's not a laid out path. There's not any one way to do that, just like there isn't any one way to do indoctrination in and of itself. So it's like, it's kind of refreshing to hear your perspective on this and to see, you know, how fresh these wounds still are, and to see that, like, you are still obviously quite frustrated being only 6 months out of the church at what has, you know, how much it's had an impact on your family and your day-to-day life, and how you're realizing now that your worth as a human being is much more than your ability to bear children. Like, that's such a huge deprogramming process and is not easy to do.
Yeah, and now I'm dealing with severe anxiety. I've got moderate depression. I just started going to a counselor there at the VA. Hopefully that isn't the death of me there. 'Cause the VA, let's trust them with my head. But
but it's better than trusting nobody or only yourself with your head. And, so I'm glad to hear that.
I mean, that's part of the problem, because there were times I was going through, like, I know it was depression, but I didn't see anyone about it, and I just called it my dark times. And I would go home. If I wasn't at work, I wouldn't turn on the lights. I'd just sit in the dark, watch TV, stay away from people. And and it would carry on for months. And it was...
Wow.
It was horrible. So, yay, religion!
Yeah, I want to get kind of a feel for you since then, since these dark times. I mean, are you doing better nowadays? Are you finding an outlet in this community and a support group where there was none before? I mean, has this kind of helped you to process what happened?
I'm still dealing with that, because I don't know too many. I mean, I know Riss and her husband and, you know, a couple people, but I don't really have, I don't know anywhere here that I could go to meet up with any, you know, normal people, because I live in rural Pennsylvania, so it's not the blue parts on either side of the state where Pittsburgh and Philadelphia are. It's the red right in the middle. And I mean, I work with a bunch of, you know, Bible thumpers that think that atheists have no morals. And I work with people that think Donald Trump is doing a bang up job. So it's like, I can't talk to a lot of these people about anything going on in my head. So it's a little, it's overwhelming.
Yeah, to say the least.
So, I mean, I find my outlet with my blog, just trying to voice the frustrations going on in my head, and a little bit on the podcast, though I haven't had the courage to try and record by myself when Riss isn't available. Because I don't know how to carry on for, you know, half an hour to make an episode without someone there to have a conversation. So,
Well, I will just say, you know, I've been working in this community now for 2.5 years, and it does take time to insert yourself into any kind of community. And the thing is, you know, when you leave the church, there's no safety net to catch you. You know, when you do finally send in that letter and say, fuck this, I'm out, I'm done with this, there's not really any landing pad or anywhere else that you know, any community you can go to and, you know, just, you know, meet up with your coworkers after work and stuff. And you know, there's not really any infrastructure in place, which is, it's a shame. It really is.
Yeah.
But, you know, I can only speak from my own experience, and this is purely anecdotal. Take that for what it's worth, but it's genuine and honest. This community, the whole atheist and skeptical community, has truly been the most accepting and gracious and rewarding community to become a part of that I've ever experienced in my life. And it's because there aren't any bullshit pretensions that you have to walk around with. You know this, when you're going to church, you always have on your nice dress or your nice suit or your nice whatever. You always try and put on the happy Mormon smile and whatnot, and that goes for any church really, or for many churches. And when you jump into the atheist community, there aren't any of those pretensions. You don't have to put on the bullshit smile in order to feel like somebody is going to have a conversation with you. Everybody that I have met in this community, now granted every community has assholes, but everybody I have met so far and I choose to associate with in this community are just genuinely good-hearted people, and I consider it an honor and a privilege to call them my friends. So it takes, like, becoming, you know, trying to insert yourself into any group, any society, it takes a lot of work and time and effort. But the rewards reaped from that and the sense of community that I get now being a part of this community, they're truly indescribable. It is truly a beautiful thing, and I didn't realize that until I did put the time and effort to become part of this community. And, you know, even if that means just starting a blog and a podcast, that's the beginning of it. Jumping into this community is not an easy task, but once you do, I've found it to be such an inviting and opening and pleasant experience, and I've had conversations with people in this community I never have had, you know, about topics I've never discussed with anybody before. And it's just, I don't know, it fulfills that need for community, even if I'm not meeting with these people every week, and, you know, we only see each other at conferences maybe once or twice a year. It's the most rewarding and amazing community to be a part of, and I'm just really glad to count myself a part of it.
Yeah, when I went to the GAM Live there in Chicago, and we were there at the meet and greet ahead of time at that little pub across the street, I mean, it was so refreshing. And the people were so nice, and it was just amazing. And they're not these hopeless, just bitter, angry people. I mean, well, some of us still have some anger for certain things.
Yeah.
But justifiably so, I think.
Yeah.
But, I mean, but it was great being able to meet them.
Yeah.
And just, yeah it was good.
Yeah, and there's that innate need for community. We're such a social species that we have to be part of a community. Whether, even if we are the most introverted, you know, closed off person in the world, we still have to feel like we have some sense of belonging. And I think that that sense in my mind has been so much fulfilled where there was nothing before. So yeah, I mean, I invite anybody and everybody to try and engage with this community and try and become part of it, because all you'll find are open arms and you know, happy faces.
And congratulations for leaving the church.
I need to say congratulations to you, because my names are still on the rolls. I say It like it takes so much more effort. I mean, I said this in our very, you know, our beginning recording. Like it, I had an easy transition. Like I had it really easy in comparison to most people. It's much harder to leave the church as an adult. So I think you are due the congratulations in this conversation, Molly.
See, and it's funny because I just listened to, I think it was your first Exmo hangout that you had.
Oh, yeah?
And I was like, huh, I almost wish that I had gone through the temple just so I could see the crazy before I left. Because I didn't go on my mission, didn't get my endowment, so I never wore the holy underwear. I mean, magic underwear. Ah, dang it. But...
But you were still, like, you still attended, though. You were still considered an accepted part of the society now. And then there's, you leave and you send in the letter and it's like, well, what the fuck do I do now, right?
Yeah, I know. And I'm just like, I haven't told my parents. I have told my two sisters that left the church, but I haven't told them why. I just said I took my name off the roster.
Wow.
But they don't know that I... pretty much am like flipping off religion in general, but
yeah, they haven't listened to the podcast yet.
Oh no. In fact, like one of my sisters doesn't have Facebook and the other I have blocked from my Molly Young Mormon Facebook profile so wow. that she can't see it because I made that strictly for the podcast, mm-hmm. you know, because I have my other one that my sister is on, and my brother-in-law is on, and my mother-in-law is on, and actually my dad is on there too. And I, so when I made my Molly and Mormon one, I went and just blocked all of them preemptively so they couldn't accidentally see it. So, because I was just like, I can't try and deal with them and this all at the same time.
That's probably a healthy way to approach it. I mean, I have the two Facebook profiles too. Like, there's good reasons for it.
Yeah, I'm like, there's just I can't deal with them, and Mom already always calls and says, "Are you reading your Book of Mormon and praying?" And now I can at least tell her, "Well, I'm reading my Book of Mormon."
Right? There you go.
not with the spirit she's hoping, but you know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's unfortunately that's treated as something of always like a faith building experience. You read your Book of Mormon, you're gonna get your testimony back. But you know, now that I read, whenever I do read from the Book of Mormon with my current perspective, I can't help but laugh at the thing. I mean, it's just hilariously anachronistic and such an obvious creation of some farm boy. So yeah, if only we could share just for 5 minutes our perspective with our family members, if only we could put them in our skull for 5 minutes and show them what we know about their religion, like how much easier would that be? But unfortunately it just takes the time and it takes conversations, and there are some people, like, you know, like parents that may never listen, you know. It's hard to tell.
I mean, Dad was born and raised in the church as well. I mean, he's, oh golly, I don't know if he's the first or second counselor in the bishopric right now.
Okay.
He's
up there.
Yeah. Mom was the, I want to say the primary president for a while, and now she's with the Cub Scouts, and
Yeah, it's got your family by the balls. It's got every single one of them. Yep. Well, I want to try and somehow wrap up on a positive note. I guess...
this whole episode has been like death and depression.
Yeah, right? Risk, come back, save us. Get some comic relief in here. No, but... I think like a closing comment that I would try and add here is, like, you know, just because shit happens in our life and things can be incredibly overwhelming, especially with a massive life shift like this coming out of the church. Like, there's always there's always a better community out there, and there's always some way to find that sense of belonging that was offered by the church. It may not be the same. Well, it hopefully isn't the same, and it may not have the same feeling. It may not be all of the same faces and friends who we grew up with and stuff, but there's still a community out there for everybody who's looking for it. It's just a matter of taking the time and effort to find it and to find a passion and to find that sense where it fills that human need to belong to a community. And I think that's what I'm most hopeful for with the secular and atheist community. As the country seems to be on fire in so many ways and so many things, they feel like they're crashing and burning. There's a lot of optimism to be had out there. Things are actually pretty great when we look at it through an optimist lens. And when we do feel like we belong to a group of friends and a community that accept us for who we are, that's incredibly beneficial and I would argue even necessary for humans to live happy lives.
To thrive, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Well, thank you for coming on the show. I have had a blast talking to you.
Likewise, right, Molly. This has been a really fun conversation today. I mean, it's been broken up for the listeners, but I mean, I've really enjoyed talking to you. And like I said, I mean, talking to you now has kind of renewed, you know, it's refreshed my sense of why the hell I'm crusading against the church so much, because, you know, their membership numbers may be dwindling, but fuck, they're still damaging a lot of people's minds, and that's worth fighting against.
Yeah, I mean, if even a third of them feel from it the way it made me feel, oh my gosh. That's,
yeah, I mean, even that's a lot of damage. Few of them,
it's horrific. And
it's true.
Oh, and I mean, from a young age, you've got all this stress about, well, even though I just took the sacrament, somehow I've already sinned, even though I'm still sitting in church. Because that's the mindset that they drill in you. And it's just, oh, it's mortifying. It's horrible. It's just, so carry on the good fight and kick some Mormon ass.
And likewise to you. I mean, this is like, it is a constant fight, and it's easy to feel or to become apathetic or feel like it's a losing fight, but like it's a fight worth having. It is a battle worth waging, and you know, if even one person is able to say that the church is bullshit after they listen to Doubting Dogma or to Naked Mormonism, then that makes it all worth it, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
There you go. And it sounds like you're processing the indoctrination by, you know, doing this podcast and by your blog and everything. It sounds like you're beginning to process the information, and I really hope that you're kind of on an upward trajectory, and that trajectory continues as you kind of wash yourself clean of the Mormon stank. That's,
yeah, that's, I was like, right? The taint. Oh goodness. Okay, so if they want to follow you, because you know my podcast has such a huge audience that has never heard of you, where would they go?
Well, they can go to the episode of Naked Mormonism that has you on it, where this section is going to be aired, this segment that we just recorded is going to be aired, or they can do so by Googling Naked Mormonism or following on Facebook and Twitter. And of course, it's a crowdfunded project on patreon.com/Naked Mormonism. So that's how I'm able to do this as a full-time research job. So, that being said, thank you for inviting me on. This has really been a fun conversation. I know we didn't get to read anything out of the Miracle of Forgiveness, but I feel like
it is a horror show unto itself.
We'll have to leave that for next time. How's that sound?
Cool. Absolutely. But yes, thank you for joining me today, and it's been a blast having you.
Agree. Thanks for having me on.
All right.
Bye.